This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which travel cards are actually worth the annual fee and which just look shiny, how to plan group trips that don't bust your budget or your friendships, when to book peak season trips without paying peak season prices, and more. So travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
You've likely heard of ultra marathon runners, people who push themselves to physical extremes, racking up hundreds of miles in difficult conditions just to reach a finish line that few dare to chase. Well, today, I'm introducing you to the travel world's version of that, Carl Brothers. And he's not running, but what he's doing takes insane planning, stamina, and a level of dedication that will likely blow your mind. And for the very first time, he's telling his full story right here on our show. This is a rare behind-the-scenes look at a travel quest so extreme that if the Guinness Book of World Records had a category for points and miles and status, he'd be in it. And by the time you hear this episode, he may already actually be in it. This is one of the most ambitious points and miles and just in general travel quests I've ever heard of. And by the end of this episode, I think your jaw might be where mine was when I first heard about it. On the floor. Buckle up, because this one is wild.
Imagine pursuing your dreams of exploring the world's most exquisite destinations without the extravagant price tag. This is the Revolutionizing Your Journey podcast, hosted by DeAndre Koch, founder of Boldly Go and an expert in financial planning as recognized by Forbes. This podcast is your bridge to a world where travel savvy meets luxury. With DeAndre's unique financial planning perspective, you'll glean insights on making the most of credit card loyalty points and miles for travel that doesn't just move you, but takes you places that you may have never thought possible. Expect the most up-to-date credit card strategies for points and miles, stories from successful professionals on how they integrate travel into their busy lives, and other captivating stories from around the globe. Whether you're a seasoned traveler or just starting out, join us in exploring the best of global travel and learn how to experience nearly free luxury travel around the world yourself. Your journey transforms here, igniting our revolution in the world of travel.
Welcome to the Revolutionizing Your Journey podcast. I am your host, DeAndre Koch. Today, I've got a really interesting guest for you guys. And I say interesting because the story behind what he is looking to do, I think, is amazing, mind-blowing. And I have a feeling when you guys hear what Carl Brothers is looking to accomplish, your jaw might be on the floor like it was when I found out. So, Carl, welcome to the show.
Hi, DeAndre. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here today.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Carl. So before I let you share what you're wanting to accomplish, first tell us a bit about yourself. You know, where are you? Where do you live? You know, kind of what do you do for a living? And how did you get into the points and miles world in general?
So my name's Carl. I live in Denver with my husband and our 12-year-old cat, Haru. And I've been in the miles and points game for a while now. I believe my very first credit card was in 2008, and it was a United Club card. Ever since then, with the bonus miles, I kind of have been collecting them. And I think my very first redemption was this full around the world trip that I'm still proud of. And after that, it just became an addiction.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, I've put enough mystery behind it. Can you share what you are currently on the quest to accomplish right now?
So I'm on the quest to fly 4 million lifetime miles on United so that I can achieve global services for life. So lifetime miles, meaning I have to be on a United branded airplane for 4 million miles. So each destination would have a standard statute miles distance, and then that's how my trips are determined. So for example, one of my bread and butter routes would be Denver to New York to San Francisco to Singapore, then back to San Francisco, New York, then Denver. And that's just my one example of the routes that I take.
So that just brings me to two immediate questions. The first one is, what does United Lifetime Global Services status actually mean? Because at 4 million miles, A, that's a lot in general, but what's the benefit? What do you actually get with this? I've never actually heard of this myself.
Global services is this invite-only status at United. So normally, these are for high-value passengers. And word on the street is that these passengers normally spend between $50,000 to about $80,000 a year in quality airfare. So it means that it's a businessman buying a last-minute business-class airfare across the Pacific or to London or across the Atlantic. So in general, these are the folks that bring a lot of revenue to United. And the status has almost achieved this mythical urban legend type of elite status that people kind of clamor for every year. So we do have folks that at the end of the year, they try to fly a little more or spend a little more so that they can achieve the 1K status. Global services is on a totally different level. It's supercharged in terms of the amount of money that they spend. So imagine 50 to 80,000 a year. However, United Airlines has this published way of getting global services, and it's by flying 4 million miles. Otherwise, on an annual basis, you're at the mercy of United Airlines, and they're pretty secretive about the criteria. So I've known somebody that works in the same team, and even after they've left, they're not sharing any information on how to qualify for global services. But in the old school forums like Flyer Talk, folks that have been loyal to United for decades, they do talk among themselves to see who qualifies for global services. So there is a Google Sheets online where people put in like how much they spend, how many flights they took, when they got invited, and other factors that they think would be important in getting selected for global services. But at the end of the day, there's no published way of getting global services except by flying 4 million miles. And one of the benefits, the Million Miler program at United, they did just change the program recently. So starting 2027, Million Milers, folks that have flown a million miles on United, they achieve gold status for life. Normally, before 2027, they can share whatever status they achieve for the year to whoever designated partner that they have. So as long as the partner lives in the same mailing address, they can be nominated through the system. So, for example, I'm a business traveler. I achieve 1K this year and I'm a million miler. Whoever I choose, be it my spouse, my best friend, or my neighbor, they will enjoy my status, which is 1K for the year. So at 2 million, United gives million milers the ability to share their status. And then the minimum status that they have for the rest of their life would be platinum. At 3 million, it's 1K. And this is where it gets fun. Because at the 1K level, you start getting plus points for achieving a certain spend requirement or an elite requirement. And that's about 320 plus points. And that translates to about 8 long haul upgrades if you purchase the right ticket. So you know, for a normal couple, 8 long haul upgrades a year means 2 big trips. And, you know, for the most of us, that covers our vacations for the year. So that's one of the reasons why we decided to pursue lifetime status at United. So then at 4 million, you get global services where there are lots of unpublished benefits and perks, but the internet knows that this is the status where you get escorted from one jet bridge to the other jet bridge using a BMW i7, or you get escorted by global services agent from one gate to the other. Or let's say, for example, you have irregular operations in your travel. Usually there are agents in the background or taking a look at your future itinerary and protecting your travel so that in case that your flight's delayed, you already have a backup. So those are some of the benefits on the surface level that we're really flying 4 million miles for. But at the end of the day, it's also about upgrades because now I can travel cheaply by, you know, a reasonable economy class ticket, use my plus points to upgrade to business class. And being global services, the upgrades are processed first before everyone else. So the fact that you have special access to award space compared to others is a big benefit for us.
So it sounds like a lot of what you're saying here with global services is something that I know in the American Airlines world, which is where we're super loyal to, is similar to their concierge key, which is kind of this mythical status where, I mean, it exists, but there's no published way specifically on how to get there. I've seen forums where people talk through very similar how much they spend, how much they flew, the fact that they had to requalify every single year and it was invitation only, although the luggage tag that you get as concierge key is like part of an actual airplane. So there's like some really amazing things on the concierge key side where I've seen at like Miami and other airports where they pick you up. I don't think it's a BMW. I think it's might be like a high-end Cadillac or something like that, that picks you up from the jet bridge, takes you to your next plane. So I know American has something similar. I'm not sure exactly, of course, how they compare when you're in this ultra high invite only status tier, but that is really interesting that United has it as well, because often, again, being the fact that I might fly one United flight a year, but I fly American every single month. And I always hear, you know, concierge key first, right? And almost no one ever boards there as concierge key. I'm not sure with you being in Denver, being a major United hub, if you often see the global services members kind of boarding first or how rare it is to find them. But I do think it's really interesting because I think that gives some of us perspective to understand, okay, global services is the ultimate invitation only level with United, which is fantastic. Now, one of the things I've got to ask you, Carl, because it's one thing to say, yes, I plan to fly, you know, I'm going to hit 4 million miles to achieve this. What's your time frame to do this? Because I think that's probably one of the most shocking pieces about this story is how fast are you trying to accomplish 4 million miles?
So we set our goal for me to do 4 million miles in 4 years. So that's about 1 million miles a year. And on average, I can fly about 85,000 miles per month. That does sound a lot on paper. But for example, for one of my bread and butter routes, let's say, for example, I go Denver, New York, cross the country to San Francisco, then to Singapore and backtrack all the way to San Francisco, New York, and Denver. That gives me about 25,350 miles. So if you repeat that route 4 times a month, mentally, you have 100,000 a month. And then repeat that 10 months in a row, then you get 1 million miles. So in terms of planning and in terms of strategizing and in terms of mentally preparing for the mileage runs, knowing that I can do 25,000 a week and just do it day in, day out, day in, day out, after 40 months, I'll have 4 million miles. It does sound crazy. I forgot to mention earlier that my husband and I own 2 hair salons and a barber shop here in Denver, and we've hired the right people to help manage the salons for us. So it gives us the time and some of the resources to pursue something like this. And the way we justified this in the middle of the pandemic was that, you know how some retirees, they would invest in their recreational vehicles so that they can go camping every summer or they can go explore the United States. Those RVs cost between 200 to 300,000 fully loaded.
Right.
And the way I'm doing my mileage runs, I do have this metric called cost per mile or cents per mile. So I'm only willing on average to spend 4 cents per mile. So at 4 cents per mile, 1 million miles is about $40,000. So my goal was to spend $160,000 or less in order to achieve global services for life. Going back to the annual qualifications for global services, it's between $50,000 to $80,000 a year. So, you know, the way we calculated it is that I can spend $60,000 for the next 3-4 years, get global services for life, and enjoy the perks of that. You know, it's like, yes, I can purchase enough tickets for a year, or I can go through a corporate program called Pass Plus, where I would prepay $50,000 worth of airfare, use that throughout the next 12 months, and in exchange is that the United Airlines would give you global services status upfront. However, I participated in this program the first 2 years. The third year, they increased it to 75,000. I have some friends that are still participating in the program, but 75,000 is a little bit too steep for some people. And I think as of this year, United has gone away with the individual Pass Plus program. So there used to be like 3 ways of getting global services: organic spend, 4 million miles, or getting a Pass Plus. Pass Plus is no longer a viable option for a lot of individuals, but corporations still sign contracts with United and they can hand out global service or 1K status to their employees. And there is one more mythical level above global services, but we can talk about that later.
Okay, wow. So I think that was a great explanation, but also I appreciate you adding some backstory, because I know anyone hearing this being like, whoa, 4 million miles in 4 years, that sounds like a lot. And then you break down flying 100,000 miles roughly a month, give or take 85 to 100,000 miles a month. And then you broke down a leg or a flight that's 25,000 miles in that, like per week, it's like, how in the world do you have the time / the resources to do that? But when you break down the fact that you had a logical thought process around it, which as a, you know, financial advisor, I'm always trying to think through and talking through financial and fiscal responsibility. At first, it's easy for me to be like, that sounds ridiculous. But at the same time, there's a good amount of logic in that as well. Because yes, individuals that want to buy, whether it's an RV, I mean, a nice boat can easily cost $250,000. You know, a second home, a vacation home, a lake house, a beach house, whatever it may be, there's a cost to that. And it doesn't hurt to say, hey, this is what we're passionate about. We want to travel and we want to get great value out of our travels. And so I think that's a really interesting way to frame that. So I'm really curious, you mentioned around COVID, you kind of reasoned about, you know, doing this. I'm curious, was there a point, or maybe you hit a status or where you want a flight where it just clicked and you're like, you know what, 4 million miles, 4 years, I think we can do this. Like, well, I'm really curious, what was the point where this like switch went on in your head when it was like, hey, I think we can do this. Should we do this? Yeah, we can do this. Let's do it. Like, what was that moment like?
So it was over the pandemic. My husband and I were discussing what I wanted to do post-pandemic. At this point, I just left my corporate career and I was focusing on the small businesses that we had. And again, hiring the right people, it didn't require my 40 hours a week focusing on the businesses. So the time was right and we had the resources to do it. So it kind of was the right timing. However, with the idea of flying to 4 million miles has been in the back of my mind for the last 10, 15 years. It all started with an article about Tom Stucker, the guy at United that's flown 24 million miles. And it was maybe a United USA Today story where they were talking about him getting a plane named after him after hitting 10 million miles. And he was talking about like, oh, I just broke my record for flying 1 million miles. I just did it a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, I'm a math guy, analytic guy. So the back of my brain, it was like, this article was published in November. So a couple of weeks ago must have been like mid-October. So if he did 1 million miles in 10 months, that's about 100,000 miles a month. And that's where the 100,000 miles a month kind of stuck in my head. You know, it's like, if I can do 100,000 miles a month, I can beat this guy's record. So it was more about, yes, I want to beat this guy's record. Two, I want global services for life. Having traveled for a while, having enjoyed my husband's million miler status, he became a million miler about 15 years ago, and we've had gold status for life. And so when I started my consulting career after grad school, I was traveling for work. I already had gold status, and everyone at work barely had silver. So I enjoy the perks of having status and not having to quote unquote work for it by flying X amount of miles. That really spoiled me for life. And I think it was over the pandemic that my husband said, it's like, how's my gold status treating you? And I said, well, you know, it's like 25% upgrade chances depending on the station. Like if I'm flying out of Tulsa back to Denver, that's pretty much guaranteed. But if I'm flying from Denver to San Francisco, forget about it because it's a GS heavy flight. And going back to your question, like when I'm at Denver, there are certain airports where, let's say, they call pre-boarding and then half of the gate goes to the pre-boarding station because there are a lot of 1Ks, there are a lot of GSs. So I've experienced that where United wants to make you feel special, but at the same time, the requirements for being 1K was low in the last couple of years so that there was a dearth of 1K folks. So upgrades were scarce. There are lots of people kind of competing for the attention of the flight attendant. And I guess it's a good thing that United is increasing the requirements for 1K so that to kind of answer that complaint from a lot of folks that there's a lot of 1Ks, I cannot use my plus points. The benefits they're giving us is useless. And one thing I really like about the Mileage Plus program is that, you know, they've been responsive to customers' complaints, suggestions, recommendations. So every year there's a little bit of evolution into the program. This year, they did neuter a little bit of the Million Miler program by limiting the ability of 1 million milers to share their status. But at the same time, I think it's a very calculated move from United's part. So Million Milers in general are a group of people that fly a lot. And they usually share their Million Miler status to their spouses, who really, for the most part, they don't care as much in flying as much as they're as a primary member. So a lot of the times, like, the beneficiaries of the Million Miler status doesn't really care much for the status anyway to begin with. The folks that really are getting affected by this are the folks that fly enough on United Airlines, but they don't fly enough to achieve 1K status on their own. So they're riding on the coattails of other Million Milers. So this adds to the problem of having way too many elites and not being able to enjoy our benefits. So with this calculated move this year with the Million Miler program, I think it's a really good change. I do feel sorry for the folks that do get affected by this, but at the same time, you fly enough on United to know the benefits, and I think United just wants you to fly more to get, like, the elite benefits that you really deserve. So,
hey everyone, quick break from the episode. If you're enjoying the show, make sure you're subscribed on whatever platform you're listening on so you never miss an episode. And if you've gotten any value so far, it would mean the world if you left a quick rating or review. It helps more people discover the show and keeps us motivated to keep creating great content. Also, if you're feeling stuck or want help with points and miles, whether it's picking your first card, planning a big redemption, or even having someone book it all for you, we've got you covered. There's a link in the show notes to schedule a free points and miles consultation. Just fill out a quick questionnaire, tell us your goals, and we'll take it from there. And don't forget, our newsletter and private Facebook group are great ways to stay on top of breaking news, updated card offers, and tips that don't always make it into the podcast. You'll find those links in the show notes as well. Now, back to the episode. So, Carl, I want to, in a second, get to the actual strategy and execution. You just mentioned at a high level, right, like the route that you take and the 25,000 miles you can get from that. I want to dig a little bit deeper into that. But before we go there, I want to ask two questions. A, would you be the first person to do this quickly, or the fastest, I guess, would be the best way to ask that? Is this to your knowledge, at least?
To my knowledge, I think I'm the only one that's speed running to 4 million miles. Normally, as I said, these are career businessmen that fly for their jobs. The prevailing wisdom at United is that it takes a business traveler about 12 years to fly a million miles if you fly about 6 trans-Pacifics a year. So it does take somebody a long time. If I was a normal business traveler, it would have taken me 48 years to do this, but I'm doing it in 4. But then again, the reason for that is that I'm 41 right now. I have the next 40 years to enjoy global services. Rather than being at retirement age at 65 and flying the last 100,000 to get to the 4 million, and how many years do I have to enjoy lifetime global service? So, you know, that was part of our calculation with my husband about to retire. We do have an age gap. And with him being able to enjoy global services too, I think that was the icing on the cake and that sealed the decision for us to kind of go for global services for life. I mean, it is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And I'm almost done. I'm just 7,000 miles short. So I'm there.
I was literally about to ask you, as of this recording, where are you at?
I'm at 3.98 or 3.99. I just have one flight to New York in 2 days. Then I come back to Denver to pick up my stuff. Then I go with my husband to San Francisco, where 30 of my friends have bought tickets to join me on a San Francisco to Sydney flight. These are the friends that I've made. These are part of the community that I've been part of, that I've helped been building. We're mainly based out of Facebook, and we're United loyalists, we're United enthusiasts that are on at the minimum 1K global services in Million Milers. So folks that really spend a lot on United, but at the same time, they love United enough that they would find excuses to fly. An example of that was that last week, as part of my 4 million mile victory lap, I organized this 7-hub run where in one 24-hour period, we were going to fly through all 7 United hubs from Newark, D.C., Chicago, Houston, Denver, San Francisco, L.A. it became an event. It was mostly community driven. And then we informed United and they kind of showed up, pulled out all the stops and gave us surprises at each station. So in Newark, there were gigantic displays, balloons, a breakfast spread, a little running bib to kind of signify that we're running. So it was nice of United to kind of go with the theme and go along with us and support our little community-led event.
That's awesome. And you talked about speed running. So just to clarify, I mean, some of these flights, I mean, that one you just talked about, that's all domestic. But for some of these flights, when you're like crossing oceans and such, I imagine, I mean, you're essentially living on the plane because you're not really like getting off to enjoy like a 3 or 4 day vacation in Sydney. Is it just you land and then you turn right back around and just go back the other way?
Yeah. So when I arrive at these foreign destinations, I just go there, go to the lounge, get a shower, wait for the plane to be clean and turn around. In the industry, flight attendants call this turn as a turn and burn. And when I talk shorthands with the FAs and I say, oh, I'm turning around in Singapore. And they usually understand that I'm just waiting for the plane to be clean. Yes, I go to these destinations and correct, I do live on the planes for about 65 hours. For a while there, when people asked me where I lived, I would say I live in 42 Lima. That's my favorite seat. It's the exit row window. One of the tips that I can give for long-haul flying is that if you're going to sleep upright, if you can elevate your feet, that makes a world of difference. So I would slum it in, coach. I've learned the art form of sleeping upright and using one seat. I've also learned the art form of sleeping across two seats and three seats, and this is what I call ghetto first class. Ghetto first class is when like a whole row is empty so that you can lay down. Laying down really helps a lot. For these 17-hour ultra long haul flights, for the most part, you kind of just wait for the time to kind of pass by, try to be productive, do some work, watch some movies. But for the most part, it's just sleeping. The nice thing about the flights that I take is that they usually leave out of San Francisco really late at night. And so by the time I get on the plane in San Francisco, I've already taken two flights out of the day. I'm pretty exhausted. It's the right timing for me to kind of get on the plane, get settled, and then like sleep for 4 or 5 hours. And then after that, kind of mid-flight service, chat with the flight attendants. You know, like chatting with the flight attendants can take like 1, 2, 3 hours, depending on how good the conversation is. Or it's gotten to a point that I would take this exact same flights week in, week out, that my record is having the same flight attendant for 6 weeks in a row. His name is Bonet. Hi, Bonet. He's a language flight attendant for the India routes out of Newark. So in the beginning, I would fly Denver, San Francisco, Newark, Delhi, and then back to Newark, San Francisco, Denver. And this was before the Ukraine war started, so we were still able to fly over Russia. Now that we can't fly over Russia, there are certain routes that are not technically feasible anymore or economically feasible. So that's part of the reason why I stopped flying to India.
So hold up here. You mean to tell me you've done essentially, I'm just going to round up and say 4 million miles, and you're talking super long haul flights, and these are all in economy?
Yeah.
This puts you in my head as essentially an ultra marathon runner, but just on a plane as opposed to, you know, grizzling it out, you know, running through the Sahara Desert. Like this is mind blowing. So this whole time, I was just assuming that with the status and all the things, you're doing this business class back and forth, but economy? Wow.
So business class would make it a little bit too unaffordable. Part of the game that I play is I'm only willing to spend X amount of dollars per mile flown. So that's my cost per mile. For my legendary Singapore runs, where I would go from Singapore all the way to New York and back, I can get that as low as $765 or $799 for the whole trip. So that puts me at 3.47 cents per mile, which is still good, below my 4 cents. And the reason for that, this is my assumption, is that that market is really saturated. Singapore to New York, you have Singapore Airlines as your competitor. And Singapore Airlines has 3 flights a day from Singapore all the way to JFK, Newark, and a third JFK flight from Frankfurt. So, you know, like they're sending 2 A350s and a 777 to New York every day. So once in a while, United wants to compete and they would compete in price. And I think it comes every October. mid-October, where the prices go down to $7.65 for basic economy, $7.99 for regular economy. And I have to caveat, this ticket is coming from Singapore all the way to New York. And I have to explain why I buy tickets from Singapore all the way to New York and then back to Singapore. This allows me to schedule the flight so that it looks like I'm turning around in Singapore. So for ticket A, let's say it goes back to the States on a Wednesday and then flies back to Singapore on that following Monday. So the evening flight out of San Francisco arrives 2 calendar days on Wednesday morning in Singapore. So once I arrive in Singapore, I would buy a second ticket that would leave just after that plane arrives from San Francisco. So it looks like I'm doing a turn in Singapore. But the ticket that I'm buying is a Singapore-US Singapore ticket that stays in the US for about 4 or 5 days. And I do have the luxury of time here. So once these fare sales like do drop, I buy 10, 15 at a time. So that every Monday, I would fly out to Singapore and return every Wednesday. So if I do that for the whole quarter, my whole 3 months is booked and I'm flying to Singapore week in, week out. I do like Singapore because San Francisco, Singapore is the second longest in the system. The longest in the system is Houston, Sydney, but that only happens maybe 3 or 4 months a year. So, and in general, Singapore really is cheap, even before when my husband was doing mileage runs 15 years ago. Singapore was in the 700, 800, 900 range. So even like 20 years later, the same amounts are still true. So for somebody that was mileage running to Singapore before from New York, if they get it for 900, they'll pounce on it. So it's the same thing right now. If it's at 799, I pounce on it. I tell my friends that it's available, and I do have maybe a half a dozen people that do Singapore turns with me. There's Jordan. We actually met in flight. He found out that I was doing this, and now we become friends, and we fly San Francisco, Singapore maybe 2 or 3 times a month when I was still doing mileage runs. There are several of us kind of that do this, and San Francisco, Singapore really is the most time efficient and most cost efficient.
So before we wrap this up, Carl, can you just talk through, I'm just really curious, and I'm sure the listeners will be curious as well, like there's got to be some logistical hurdles, emotional hurdles. I mean, this takes mental stamina, physical stamina as well. I mean, this is almost like a sport for you. How are you able to do it? How are you able to overcome whatever it may be, sleep deprivation, the turn and burns, the living in an airplane for months? How do you do it?
I kind of just started doing it. I've always loved flying. Being in an airplane was like fun and joy for me. So knowing that I'm going to be in an airplane for 15 hours, I'm in heaven. But in the beginning, it was a little bit difficult because I wanted to experience every hour of the flight. So I would stay up for all 15 hours, even though I've already stayed up for 20 hours. That wasn't sustainable. The trick was that I stayed on to Denver time zone. I mean, I might be a couple of hours off here and there, but in general, I stayed to Denver time zone. So when I fly out of San Francisco to Singapore, it leaves 10 p.m. San Francisco time. It's 11 p.m. Denver time. So it really is the right time for my sleeping. As for the mental and emotional preparation, I didn't have much of that. It was more, let's just do it, fly, get it done. I think in the first year, the first 2 years, I remember telling myself, I just really want more time on the ground. It's like 4 days is not enough. And I remember kind of like bitching to my husband about that. It's like, I just want more time on the ground. But as time went on, I was able to kind of get all the things that I needed to do on the ground within like a day or two. So, you know, I had my routine. I would do laundry. I would repack. I would get all the mail done, get all the housework done. And I can be out in 2 days. I mean, my record of flying into Denver, going home, and then flying out again that evening was 6 hours. I was able to do laundry, go home, like say hi to the cat, make sure that all the plants at home are taken care of, and then pack, go to Singapore. As for the physical, I know it's a lot of sitting. I did develop some sciatica in my hips, but I try to be active when I'm flying. I stand with the flight attendants in the rear galley. I walk as much as I can. But one saving grace in terms of keeping myself fit and healthy are the hotel gyms. Sometimes I would build in maybe 5 hours of a layover in San Francisco. And there's this app called Resort Pass. And it lists all the hotels in the area that would let you use their pools or that would let you use their gyms for a fee. So I believe it was the Grand Hyatt at San Francisco that was my favorite gym. You know, it's like if I have 5 hours, I'll take the hotel shuttle, get food delivered there, go to gym, put in a workout, and then go back to the airport, take a shower, and then hop on to the next flight. So I knew that being the physical aspect would be challenging. So I really made it a point to go to the gym at least regularly. If I don't go when I'm flying Monday to Wednesday, I'm at the gym Thursday to Sunday almost every day. Another thing for the physical aspect of flying, the food. The food was a big issue because the moment you step into the airport, like you go into the club and you don't have anything to do, so you start grazing the corn nuts. And then you get on the plane, they give you your first meal service. So you get your sugary drink, you get your salty snacks, then you get a free snack box. So it does add up if you eat all the meals that they present to you. So I've learned to bring my own food. I had a period where I would order a whole pizza for myself, bring it onto the plane, and everyone would be jealous because I have pizza for a 15-hour flight. However, you put on weight really fast with pizza. So, you know, I'm skinny, but at some point I put on 10 pounds just because of eating pizza. So I became more conscious about what I eat. You kind of become creative with the in-flight meals. I mean, I've hung out with enough flight attendants that they've taught me how to make an in-flight Mai Tai, or they've taught me how to use ingredients from one meal and then use another ingredient from the other meal to make an in-flight meal. So it's kind of really living on planes. And for the longest time, I thought I was a pretend flight attendant. About 20 years ago, before I moved to the States, I did train to become a flight attendant. But I met my husband, who asked me out on a first date, so I quit training. And shortly after that, I moved to the States and then never followed that dream.
So, Carl, I mean, incredible story. You're miles, just a few miles away, a handful of miles comparatively from achieving this. By the time this airs, you will likely have already hit the 4 million miles. So I want to be the first to give you a congratulations early because I know it's going to happen. And I don't know, I'm feeling like this is going to be in the Guinness Book of World Records or something like that. Because I mean, this sounds absolutely incredible. One of my last questions for you is, what's next after the 4 million miles? Are you going to slow down or are you going to chase another milestone, another goal? This has been basically your life for the last 4 years. What's next?
When I reached 3 million, I joked with my husband that, hey, I want to do Alaska. Like, they do have a million miler program. And at 2 million miles, you get Emerald status for life. I'm not sure of the One World Alliance, but I've heard from my friends that fly One World that Emerald status is really good.
It is. It's very good.
I think that's something to look forward to. And I think about last year, Alaska Airlines just celebrated their most frequent flyer. And he flew 3 million miles. And I was already at 3.5. So when I read this, it was like, oh, how cute. He's flown 3 million miles. But then again, if you think about it, Alaska doesn't have any long-haul flights. So he's been doing 3-4 hour flights for the last 30 years to achieve 3 million miles. So he's done more work than I have. And I think his story is also interesting. And if you want to interview somebody, this guy would be great.
Awesome. So possibly going after Alaska Airlines status. I will say, as a One World Emerald member, it is quite amazing. I think One World lounges around the world, if you have Emerald status, are some of the best lounges that I've experienced, but even from other travel enthusiasts, points and miles experts, people that travel all over the world, typically I'm hearing that the One World lounges that you can get into with Emerald status are some of the best in the world. And so I think that would be aspirational, but also amazing if you're able to achieve that. Carl, people are going to hear this and they're going to want to follow your Instagram, your journey, and see all the exciting things. I'm almost positive eventually there's going to be awards. I feel like when we go to your Instagram, there's going to be like confetti coming down or something like that, right? So where can the listeners follow you and follow your future journeys and your ultra flying marathon lifestyle?
So you can find me online at United Million Miler, both on YouTube and Instagram. I just started this maybe 3-4 months ago, and I'm surprised that no one has taken this username. But I guess in the world of travel content creation, there's only a handful of people that are million milers at United. So follow me at United Million Miler or UnitedMillionMiler.com.
Awesome, Carl. This has been fantastic. This has been very different. My jaw is on the floor from A, what you're accomplishing, B, the timeline you're accomplishing it, and C, the fact that you're doing it primarily in economy is absolutely wild. But I think in just like in fitness and other places, there are people that are just, they're on a different level. They're focused, they're goal oriented, and they go after it. And you are absolutely showing and have proven that it's possible to do that as well. I'm curious, one of the last questions I have about the million mile status. So once you have the 4 million miles, the global services for life, is there a flight that you have in mind or a trip that you have in mind for you and your husband that you plan to take utilizing your global services benefits, like something very specific to like after the dust settles?
So one of the great benefits of global services is that you can use your plus points on award fares. Normally, you can only use plus points on cash fares. So disability is limited to just global services folks. There's going to be an inaugural from San Francisco to Adelaide in December. And, you know, with these inaugurals, the prices are always exorbitant. But economy saver award was like 40,000 each way. So I'll put ourselves on the upgrade wait list once in global services. But that's our plan. We'll fly to Adelaide. If our upgrade's clear, then we go. If we doesn't clear, then we go back to Denver. That's kind of our travel philosophy. In August, we're also doing Greenland. Same thing. If our upgrade's clear, we go. If it doesn't clear, then we don't go. So it's really the flexible travel opportunities that United has. And right now, most of our travel's dictated where United goes. So there is this song from J-Lo where she kind of enumerates all these different locations like Brazil, Morocco, London, Ibiza, LA, New York, Vegas. United flies to all of those except Ibiza. So I just need United to fly to Ibiza so I can do a TikTok of this song. So United, please fly to Ibiza.
As soon as you started saying that, the song immediately started playing in my head, which is awesome. Carl, as you keep saying this, I actually keep thinking of additional questions. I know we can wrap this one up. Do you happen to have an idea? This is the financial advisor brain in me kicking in. Do you happen by chance to have an idea? I don't even know if this is a roundabout or a just rough guess or assumption, but the cost to do this in this 4-year period, which you kind of broke down the math and the logic behind it, what that will save you over the next, estimated lifetime of travel with upgrades and other things, how that balances out by chance that you happen to know those numbers or ran an idea or simulation of that?
I haven't projected into the future, but for an example, instead of paying maybe $3,000 per person to fly one way from San Francisco to Osaka, last year I paid $900 and 40 plus points and 40,000 miles for two people to fly to Osaka. So, it's a savings about maybe $5,000. For a two-person flight, there was $1,000 outlay, 40,000 miles and 120 plus points. So it's about $6,000 that I can save per trip.
I mean, that's awesome. So from the standpoint of, $5,000-$6,000 of savings per trip, with the status and your flexibility and your lifestyle for you and your husband, I mean, you could take a handful or more of trips each year. I mean, that absolutely does add up. If you're saving $5,000 per trip, and that's five trips a year you're taking because you have the flexibility to do that, you're saving $25,000 a year. In 10 years, that's $250,000 in savings just in 10 years. And like you said, you're doing this now in your 40s with a life expectancy of, ideally 40 plus more years behind you. I mean, the maths, which was really cool, you said that you did this early on, you figured out the logic of it. I'm just so impressed. And this was absolutely fantastic, absolutely interesting to chat with you, Carl. So I appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It was great talking to you. It was like just talking to a friend. And I've enjoyed this podcast experience. Thank you.
Absolutely, Carl. Absolutely. Likewise, the feeling is mutual. The actual last couple of questions we have for you, outside of the individual you mentioned with Alaska Airlines, which I don't know if you know him personally, anyone else you think that should be on this show that the listeners would find a lot of value in hearing from?
At least going on with the Million Miler, I think the gentleman, his name is Stephen Ralph of Alaska Airlines. I think he'd be a really interesting guy. His journey is a little bit different from mine, but at the same time, we're chasing after the same thing, which is lifetime status. And one thing I like about United is that's a mainline carrier. So it has a global network. So it means that I can explore the world. Alaska doesn't have a global network. So it kind of makes me double think if I really want to pursue that.
Perfect, perfect. And then lastly, Carl, any final thoughts, any last bits of wisdom, anything we left out as you share your story and you're about to accomplish this again? By the time this thing goes live, you will have already been and hit that 4 million miles. You will have your global services for life. You will have the story of a lifetime and probably a Guinness Book of World Records entry as well. Any final thoughts before we wrap this one up?
You know, just be kind to your fellow travelers, be kind to the in-flight crew. They are human. They're working really difficult jobs. And, you know, if you give out kindness into the world, they'll give it back to you. And that makes for a better flight experience.
Be kind to the people you travel with. Carl, thank you so much again for being on the episode today. For the listeners out there, if you enjoyed this episode, if you found it interesting, exciting, different, make sure to subscribe. Keep following our show for more content like this, content in points and miles, and incredible, incredible travel stories. Make sure to follow us on all the social media channels and follow Carl as well at the United Million Miler website and account on Instagram. I think he's got an incredible journey. And just as you might be interested in following someone that's an ultra marathon, ultra sport athlete, I think Carl is the definition of an ultra athlete in the world of aviation. And as always, don't forget to like, share, subscribe, tell your friends, and we will catch you on the next episode. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to the Revolutionizing Your Journey podcast, brought to you by Boldly Go. Hit that follow button so you don't miss out on new episodes. For deeper insights and to level up your travel game with our strategies, make sure to follow us on our social media platforms and sign up for our newsletter to stay in the loop. Head over to www.boldlygo.world to learn more. As DeAndre is not operating through this podcast as a fiduciary and/or financial advisor, this should not be considered personal financial advice. The information covered and posted has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The strategies and results referenced on this site, while proven, are not guaranteed. While most who apply the principles referenced will achieve similar results, you may not yourself. Your results will vary and depend on many factors that may be in or out of your control, but include factors such as your credit score, financial status, business experience, etc. It is your responsibility to consume and implement these recommendations at your own risk. We cannot be held responsible for any failure to do so.
Travel doesn't just happen when you get on a plane. I'm Pauline Frommer, and on the Frommer's Travel Show, we explore not just where to go, but how to bring travel into your everyday life through books, shows, and stories that shift your perspective, plus insights on smart destinations, timely trends, and interviews with the people shaping the way we explore. Find us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or voyescape.com.